This is Car Expert.
There's still not all that many affordable electric cars out there, but Cupra does seem to want to bring it in at a sharp price.
I'd actually put an order down for a GT3 RS. Talked about that with my wife and she thought that I should be locked up for spending that amount of money on a single car.
But to have this whole dramatic experience, it's just that extra level of engagement that Hyundai is just having fun with this car.
Hello, my name's Mandy Turner. Hello to Mike Costello and Pablo the Cat.
Hello. Well, he's just jumped off my lap, actually. My podcasting experience has just got 10% worse.
He was doing a sound check with tapping the paws on the microphone before, so we're all good now. Hello, Scott Colley.
Hello, Mandy Turner. It's very obvious that we're all still work from home, make it up as we go at the moment, isn't it? We've got cats. We've got all sorts of things going on.
I know. But there's some good news that has come out this week. Car Expert has won a rather large award, Moko.
Yeah, we just today actually we've just been watching the stream of the Mumbrella Publish Awards, very prestigious media industry awards ceremony emceed by comedian Dan Illich this year over Zoom rather than being a fancy cocktail event, unfortunately. But we were nominated for a few categories and we've just won Website of the Year, the 2021 Website of the Year award, beating out incredible publishers like news.com.au. So, you know, this was a stacked field. And for a business, like, we don't want to toot our own horns too much here, but for a business that's only been around for not even 18 months now, to have kind of cracked that, I mean, it's a nice moment to sit back and reflect, I think. We're all pretty proud of ourselves. And thanks to everyone that's, you know, listened and read and helped make it happen, I think.
Yeah.
We were actually nominated for 4 awards in total. Car Expert was highly commended in the event of the year, which was based on the Experience Center, and also highly commended on the website launch or relaunch of the year. The only one of our nominations that didn't end up being highly commended or winning the award, the only, we'll call it, podium misser, was our very own editor Paul Marrick, who did not earn a mention in the editor of the year category. So yeah. Condolences to Paulie, but well done to the website and the whole team, because the team ones and the ones that we were really, really hoping for came through.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm just wondering who's going to break the news to Paul. He's been out filming at a closed circuit today, and who's going to break the horrible news to the poor bugger?
Oh, look, I suppose
won't care.
It was nice for the nomination at least to be recognised in the first place. So
I'm sure he will be on the same page as us, which is the team award was the most important one, and it's brilliant news for all of us.
What an incredible effort, guys. As you said, thanking everyone for their support in the last 18 months. It's grown so quickly and so big at the same time. So awesome news. Scully, we always have a laugh at some comments that happen at the bottom of Car Expert stories. Like, some comments are actually really, really good and some we do have a bit of a laugh about. And you found one today that you thought would be worth mentioning.
I did, and it's purely for self-serving reasons. Someone said something nice about me, but we've had a few emails recently since Car Advice shut down saying that they found Car Expert and they're really happy to see the old team back together. They're going to check Car Expert daily. And one of them went so far as to say that Scott has the best voice for podcasting. He's a modern-day car version of Richard Mercer. So this is a personal car podcast dedication. Thanks, Ty. That made my week.
For anyone who doesn't know who Richard Mercer is, did you want to just fill anyone out with that?
So Richard Mercer, I don't know if he still does, but he went by the Love God at one point, and he would host Love Songs and Dedications, which is a late-ish night radio program where, you know, back before it was easy to communicate with people over the phone or Facebook or leave voice messages, you could ring up and actually dedicate a song to someone you really cared about and the whole radio would hear it. So if it were Mike doing it for Mandy, Richard would say, you know, Mike Costello's just written in and he's on the other side of Australia to Mandy right now, but he wants her to know this is for her. Mandy, this is Don't Want to Miss a Thing by Aerosmith. And then the song would play. And it was this really, really strange phenomenon. It still goes on today. Osher Gunsberg from The Bachelor, who's also a big electric car guy, now hosts it. But it's less prevalent because you can just leave voice messages on your phone or Facebook now.
Yeah. So, Scully, I'm surprised that your mum is an avid commenter on carexpert.com.au. It's good that she's supporting you, though. She doesn't have to use a fake name, though. She can just go by herself, surely.
My mum is big on all sorts of positive feedback, but reading Car Expert religiously and sending an email is not one of those things, unfortunately. She does read the site, but she's got other stuff going on in her life. I've got a younger brother she needs to worry about, so I'm confident that's not mum. I'm confident. Although if you are mum, please don't do that again.
Speaking of your family, Scully, how's your grandma enjoying her Tesla?
She's loving it. She lives down at Moggs Creek on the Great Ocean Road. So she's not driving it much at the moment because she can't go between Melbourne and Moggs. But she's really, really enjoying it. We got her all set up. There was, when we weren't in lockdown, a big family event. And I'm the eldest of a whole lot of cousins on that side of the family, and we all had a fiddle around with the car, and it now makes fart noises on the indicator and does all sorts of things that she can't work out how to turn off. But I think she's really loving how comfortable and quiet it is. She always comments on that. And I also was a little bit concerned because obviously when you're recommending a car for someone, be it through the website or in the family, you want it to be easy for them, but you also want it to be easy for you because she's got my phone number and, you know, we chat often, but I don't want daily or weekly calls saying that something's broken, I can't work out my car. She's wrapped her head around charging really quickly. She's wrapped her head around how the app works and all that stuff really quickly and is thriving as an 85-year-old woman in Tesla.
I love that so much. You should write a story about it some stage, Scully. I would so read that.
I like that idea.
Of all of the Tesla owners, by far the most likable. Much more likable than our illustrious editor, Paul, who also owns a Tesla.
It's been a nasty intro for Paul.
Oh, it really has. We love you, Paul. Let's start with news. This is pretty exciting news, actually, Scully. The Cupra-born electric car is coming to Australia.
It is. So we've had real trouble getting Volkswagen Group electric cars to Australia, with the exception of the Audi e-tron, which is at a very different end of the market. But Cupra, which is a sporty Spanish spin-off of Seat, which is a mouthful to say on a podcast, and it's meant to be their more youthful, racier kind of brand, has committed to bringing the Born, which is the same car as the Volkswagen ID4 and ID3 underneath, to Australia. That's going to launch in the middle of next year with three petrol-powered cars and two plug-in hybrids, but it's going to try and have the Born, which is a little city hatchback with up to 170 kilowatts of power and 310 newton meters of torque in Australia by the end of 2022. Hopefully, if it's not 2022, it'll be early 2023. The reasoning behind this is really interesting. We sat down this week for a dial-in remotely, obviously, with Cupra's global boss, whose name is Wayne Griffiths, and Ben Wilkes, who is Australian boss. We're going to have a sit-down with him next week in a more in-depth chat as well. But they essentially said the reason that they're able to get the Born to Australia and Skoda and Volkswagen haven't been able to get their electric cars down under is because Cupra is a small brand and Australia's one big part of its global expansion plans. The other two are really big brands with huge global presences and Australia is not as much of a priority. To quote him exactly, he said, "Australia will be our first time global. We put our resources on fixing an electric car for an Australia as an objective and a priority. I think Volkswagen Group and Skoda, because they're already global and in a lot of other markets, they probably don't give Australia the priority. For us, it'll have a high priority," which is a really strong statement from a CEO to come out and say, look, you're not a big deal to those guys, but you are to us. So Fingers crossed that Cupra can get the car here soon and that we get to enjoy driving it, because there's still not all that many affordable electric cars out there, but Cupra does seem to want to bring it in at a sharp price.
Just to give you an idea of how that manifests, it took 18 months from the launch globally of the Volkswagen Passat for it to make it to Australia. The ID3 electric car, which is the new version of the Golf in a lot of ways, or the new Beetle, the new mainstream VW car, that premiered last year in Europe and is not going to come to Australia till 2024. So when a Volkswagen subsidiary is saying, hey, we know that sometimes little old Australia gets ignored and we're not going to do that, that is a quantum shift for the Volkswagen Group. Maybe Audi is a slightly different beast. But it's not Volkswagen Australia's fault that it can't get the cars it wants all the time, nor is it Skoda's. But for Cupra, that is a massive win.
How do you think it's going to go with sales, Mocha? I know we don't have pricing, we don't know how it drives or anything like that yet, but it's a brand that's not relatively well known here.
No. Look, I mean, it's not going to be a huge volume player by any means, but we've seen brands like Polestar who are also indicating they're going to come to Australia, you know, Genesis, which has a similar business model to Cupra. So you can definitely support a premium sort of tech-driven brand with low volume like this, especially if you tap into that existing back-end stuff that Volkswagen provides. Mm. But I wouldn't have thought it will be keeping, you know, some of the better-known brands up at night as far as sales are concerned for a while. I mean, nobody knows what the hell Cupra is, for starters.
Yes.
It also, it's very aware of that. I mean, in this call multiple times they said, we don't want to be all things to all people, we want to be everything to some people. So obviously that's a pretty good tagline to have if you don't think you're going to sell many cars, but it does also prove that the brand's pretty confident in what it offers and that it's not chasing big sales numbers.
Mm. Certainly feeling the love here. Awesome stuff, Cupra. Now, we spoke about this quite a few weeks ago, the 2022 Hyundai Staria, a people mover that looks like it's come from out of space. We could be getting the business class option here, Moco.
Yeah, so you nailed it, Mandy. The Staria is a people mover that looks like it's come from outer space. It's this amazing-looking car with a full LED light bar running in front across the front and this incredibly smooth sort of silhouette with the biggest side windows you could imagine. It's like a giant greenhouse inside. Really cool to see Hyundai getting adventurous when it comes to van and to people mover design. You know, V6 front-wheel drive, diesel all-wheel drive. But this one is the exciting one. I'm going to sound like a bit of a tool here, but I remember at times in my, you know, professional existence flying at the front of the plane, flying in business class where you get the seat that reclines and you get a little bit of room to move. And I saw pictures of the interior of this Staria and I kind of, my mind took me back to those business class flights because that's exactly what this looks like. It's, you know, rather than having the 8-seat interior, that they've replaced the second row bench with individual reclining captain's chairs, three-stage heating and ventilation, two-way backrest, four-way legrest. I mean, it's like two lazy boys in the back of a crazy-looking MPV. And Hyundai Australia says that it's going to consider bringing this, I guess, for chauffeur services and limo services and things like that. But yeah, I did say that and thought, man, what a you can keep, you know, sometimes I think you can keep your sports cars. Just give me the van with the captain's recliner chairs and I'll be happy.
I was going to say I'd be more than happy to be picked up in a black Staria from the airport anytime.
We actually we've got a Staria through the garage at the moment. It's out being filmed today and I was lucky enough to drive it back from when we picked it up. I don't know that we're allowed to talk about how it drives yet because of the embargo, but I can say it looks just as wild in person as it does in the pictures. It's like a giant fishbowl with massive windows and it's awesome. It's really, really cool.
And I'll give you a teaser. I've got a comparison test coming up in the next few weeks where we're going to actually look at it alongside a Palisade. So two Hyundai products, one an $80,000 plus 7-seat SUV and one a $66,000 same drivetrain, much more spacious, much more wild-looking Staria. Just sort of say, is this whole SUV tax that people talk about real? Because it looks to me like the Staria, aside from maybe the dowdy image that people movers have, is clearly the one to go for.
Now, we've got another electric car that's been revealed, Scully, the 2022 Renault Megane E-Tech Electric.
Just in case you weren't sure it was electric, they've called it the E-Tech and put electric in the name. We get it, guys.
It's actually called Electric Tech Electric.
Yes, it's like ATM machine. So, yeah, this is quite a big deal for Renault because it recently announced a really bold turnaround plan to cut down on chasing volume and focus really heavily on electric cars, focus really heavily on saving money in its development and focus really heavily on reinventing itself with a bolder brand image. The Megane is a big seller for Renault globally. It obviously, at the moment, is a hatchback, but it's turned into, for this next generation, a little Volkswagen ID4 rivaling SUV, although it's actually smaller than the ID4. The really interesting thing for me on this is what Renault's done with the battery options. It's got the CMF EV platform underneath, which is one of the sort of shared Renault-Nissan-Mitsubishi platforms. And there's two battery options, one with 40 kilowatt hours, good for 300 Ks of range, and another with 60 kilowatt hours, good for 470. But not all of the cars get the full fast charging power. So if you're a private buyer buying the car with the smaller battery, you're only able to charge it on a home AC charger. and there are two different options. You can get it with 11 kilowatt or 22 kilowatt capability. And only the bigger 60 kilowatt hour battery is actually able to charge at 130 kilowatts on a DC public charger, which essentially means that if you buy the smaller battery, you're committing to only charging on a home wall box or on like a trickle charger when you get to a destination. If you're buying the bigger one, then you're thinking maybe you'll need to stop on the side of the highway. And I wonder if this is something maybe we'll see more from other brands.
Well, it'll certainly drive the costs down because, you know, obviously if you're going to take on DC charging, you've got to have a lot more battery cooling. you know, generally it's a form of liquid that, you know, cools the battery. I presume there's a fair bit of money that can be saved. And if it is the price leading model, we've seen, you know, cars like Leaf go without battery cooling in that sense. And maybe it's a similar move motivated by cost.
I think the other big thing with electric cars we're already seeing and we'll see more of in the future is weight saving, because obviously with any car, the more weight you have, the less efficient it is. But that's even more, you know, important in an electric car where the range number is still really prevalent in people's minds. Renault says the E-Tech weighs just 1,650 kilos, which is 400 kilos lighter than a Volkswagen ID4 and 350 lighter than a Tesla Model Y.
Now, 700 kilos lighter than a Mercedes EQC.
Exactly. Now, it is quite small. So it's actually only 4,210 mil long, which makes it about 300 mil shorter than something like a Renault Arkana or a Mazda CX-5. But it's promising to have similar levels of space inside because it's on this dedicated electric vehicle platform. If Renault is able to make an electric vehicle that's that light, it should be much better handling, for one. Mm. It should also get much better range from it because you're not lugging around a huge amount of extra weight. So there's some really clever thinking in this. I think the last thing that's worth pointing out is the interior, which looks really thoroughly modern. It's got two 12-inch screens and they sort of wrap around the driver. Renault's been on a decent direction with its interiors for a little while now, and we'll talk about the Arkana later on. This looks like they've finally fully committed to that direction and they're going fully futuristic, and I'm really excited to see in person when the car comes to Australia, if it does, or when we can swim overseas to get away from Australia, what it looks like, because it looks like Renault is really committed to a premium sort of look and feel, and I can't wait to see it in person.
I can't believe that we're talking about Renault and we're not talking about the fact that the company's bringing the Renault 5 back. Scully, yes. This is not new news necessarily, but my all-time favourite car is the Renault 5. I've even got my favourite old T-shirt has got a Renault 5 emblazoned on the front of it. And the company wants to make EVs sexy and cool, and a shortcut to do that is to bring the iconic badges back. And the company confirmed something along those lines, did they not, Scott, regarding the Renault 5? They've actually fast-tracked that program.
Yeah, they have. So the Renault 5 is built on a different platform. It's on this what they call the CMF EV instead of the CMF BEV, I think. I may have that the wrong way around. I'm sorry if I do. But it's going to be a really low-cost platform that is going to cut the price of building a new electric car by, Renault says, about 30 or 40% from memory. So wow. Based on the Renault Zoe, that means they should be able to sell a car on this platform for just over $30,000 in Australia. And the Renault 5 will be one of the first cars to come on that platform. But there's going to be other retro specials as well. They're going to do the Renault 4 Ever, which is going to be an SUV version of the 4. And then we're going to see Alpine stuff as well that sort of harks back to the past but with an electric platform underneath it. So it seems like Renault finally has, you know, a really clear direction, and it's also having some fun with its past, which is awesome because we often forget just how unique and clever these French brands once were.
Mm. Marco, I sense a new Renault 5 being in your garage soon.
Depends if I ever get these home renovations out of the way.
Yeah. And lastly, the Mercedes-Benz Concept EQG has been revealed. Basically a G-Wagon with lots of lights on it. Right, Marco?
Well, it's funny we touched on the Renault 5 and 4 because this is another retro classic that's gone electric. Obviously, the Mercedes G-Wagon is one of the most iconic vehicles around. And this one, the EQG, is what, you know, the company's calling a near-production look at the promised fully electric G-Wagon. Under the skin, it's got four electric motors. The company's not really talking outputs or too many tech specs at this stage, but two-speed transmission for sort of a pseudo-low-range type setup. It's even going to run it over the Schockel Mountain 4x4 testing track in Austria, right near the Magna plant there where it builds the petrol and diesel ones. It's got these crazy dish-like wheels and, as you said, Mandy, some sort of digital take on the traditional grille with lots of crazy fancy lights. It's a bit garish, But then again, like when they say they're going to do an electric G-Wagon, it is definitely that. It is just yes. a G-Wagon with different tardier wheels and lights and four motors rather than a diesel or a petrol engine, which is exactly what it has to be. I'm really glad that they haven't gone too over the top with it. The whole point of this car is that it's supposed to just be the car we all love, but electric. And I think it's going to be that. So very excited to see it and can't wait for the production one to hit the market.
What are the odds the Mercedes square spare wheel cover makes it to production? Because that is one of the funniest details I've seen on a concept car.
I kept thinking of that Simpsons episode where they had the wheels, the car with the square wheels. Like, what is that supposed to be? Have they put the spare under the floor? Is it a space saver? And what's in that box?
I mean, it's a concept car. I assume the box is just full of the hopes and dreams of designers, but I just, it looks like it's carrying around a backpack. It's like a little Uber Eats driver.
Yeah. It's like, you know, that new Defender has the silly one on the seat there, I think it is, on the side. It's like that, but even worse somehow, which is a real achievement. Extraneous. And this is coming from someone who owns the most useless car in the world, by the way, a Suzuki Jimny. So I'm pretty credentialed to point out useless features. Very strange. But look, this is a car that's been promised for a long time, and man, it's awesome that it's coming. Can you imagine the levels of control off-road four independent motors will give you? We've seen with the Rivians that what that can do. Just, you know, you think that tricky differentials and stuff are the answer, or torque vectoring or all these different systems, but in-hub motors, I should say, if that's what it is, or four motors, that's something else altogether.
I think also, and I know we're going on about this a bit, but if you live in LA at the moment, you probably see a fair few G-Wagons around. I think the EQG is going to be the modern Prius in some parts of LA because it's big and blocky and it's still got all the presence and the I'm rich sort of aura about it that the V8 does. But it also shows the world that you care about the polar bears. It is the perfect car for Los Angeles.
You say Los Angeles. What you really meant to say was Shanghai.
Yeah, that's also a good point.
Probably both.
If you would like a bigger news hit, head to carexpert.com.au. We have had the August VFACTS come through this week, Mocha. Can you give us a rundown on what the new car sales figures was like last month?
I can. So new car sales grew 33%, and that was despite New South Wales and Victoria being locked down. So that really shows, and Victoria especially had really good growth, which shows the click and collect sort of models that car manufacturers have had to pivot to, probably quicker than they'd planned to, are obviously working, and people are managing to actually get their hands on cars. And that's also despite stock shortages that we keep hearing about, whether it's semiconductor related, whether it's COVID shutting factories. There's a million reasons for it. And despite all those headwinds, the car industry is still up and about. And it's not just up on 2020, which was a disaster. The cumulative year-to-date tally of 732,828 sales is actually the highest since 2018. So, you know, it's actually, I mean, it's not an all-time high by any means, but it is a respectable figure. In terms of brands, obviously Toyota, far and away number one, up 60%, 20,000 sales, left everybody else in the dust. Some of the surprises would be Kia in third place, up 12%, wow. Beat Hyundai. So that's either 3 or 4 months in succession now where Kia has beat its big brother Hyundai. We also had Isuzu, Ute, and MG growing enormously to be ensconced inside the top 10. And Great Wall Motors, Haval, the two-branded single company out of China, up 400% for the month. So absolutely remarkable growth in 12th position overall. So, you know, a fair bit of change happening among some of those brands. Top-selling cars, Hilux and Ranger as always, number 1, 2. Corolla, RAV4, Prado, really very few surprises, aside probably from the fact that two MG vehicles are inside the top 20,
really?
And the new Isuzu MU-X as well. We also saw the Toyota Land Cruiser drop out because, hey, guess what? There's none left. Not a whole lot of other surprises. Pretty much every state was up bar New South Wales, which was down by 7%. Half the market were SUVs, so there were more SUVs sold than light commercials and passenger cars combined, obviously led by medium SUVs and 4x4 utes. So in those terms, pretty much to be expected.
Mike, one of the categories that jumped out of me was affordable sports cars. The Mustang has been the champion of that segment for a really long time, but two cars that are essentially sold out flipped that script completely last month.
Yeah, remind me, it was the 2 Series and the 370Z, right?
Correct, yeah.
Yeah, so well, we've obviously seen the new Z just revealed. We've also seen the new 2 Series. So as you say, it's interesting. I'm I'm going to go out on a limb here and say Ford might have some stock issues with the Mustang, just like everything else it sells aside from Ranger. But not a bad achievement there. It's pretty interesting that the old Z, maybe the publicity the new Z got inspired some people to run out and buy the outgoing car. Maybe they wanted the naturally aspirated engine experience.
It's going to be interesting to see how that segment evolves over the next little period as well, because we know Subaru BRZ's coming. We know Subaru WRX is coming, Toyota 86. So the Mustang might have its work cut out.
Indeed it will. Some other good news, private buyers up 35%. So when we talk about market growth, private buyers are actually over-indexed. It's not just businesses using JobKeeper to pump up the numbers or whatever. You know, it's actually these are mum and dad buyers buying the vehicles. Propulsion, EV minus Tesla up 140%, although still at a very low number of 370 for the month. China remains our fourth biggest trading partner behind Japan, Thailand and Korea, and now ahead of Germany. Really not a whole lot of surprises, I would say, pretty much on form for what we've seen during the course of the year. We've got a really good comment section going. We used to, at the old joint that won't be named, we used to do a sort of Reddit-style AMA Q&A with the comments on the VFAX stories. That's well and truly alive at Car Expert, and we're getting hundreds of comments, people wanting to know, you know, how their car of choice sold. So I'd encourage anyone listening to go and hop on the comments thread and get involved, because it's a fun game watching car sales.
What's the most strangest request you've had on the comments of a model car?
Well, I guess people sometimes understandably want to know how their favorite brand or model went, but sometimes it's real niche stuff, like how did the Citroen C3 sell last month, or sometimes there'll be people who want really vague, really like extraordinarily precise breakdowns, not just how did a make and model sell, but like what was the top color and transmission combo in that model. And you sometimes go, oh, I'd love to help you, but I don't quite have the sort of data needed to answer those questions. But look, it's really good fun, because the passion people have for the industry, and we've obviously got a lot of people who read the site who are in the industry and know it well, and it's a really good sort of vibe that we're building.
Yeah. Well, if you have any questions, you can fire away in the comments in the article. Marco, the Hyundai i30N has just got a whole lot easier to drive with the introduction of a DCT auto. You've had the chance to drive it. But before we get into that, surely this is going to boost the sales and will come knocking at the door of a VW Golf GTI.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, cue the tears of the enthusiasts. And look, we all own manual cars and love them, but at the end of the day, most people don't want to drive cars with three pedals. Hyundai's had one hand tied behind its back without one. And, you know, Australia was actually the third most popular market for that car anywhere in the world. About 5% of the total production haul ended up down under. So it's not as if Hyundai didn't have a hit on its hands, but now that it's got this new dual clutch, it's going to be something else. And it's not just some off-the-shelf item that it's just grabbed from the spare parts bin. This is a bespoke transmission that it's made for most of its new iteration N vehicles. Designed under the watchful eye of Albert Biermann, the former head of BMW M, honed at the Nürburgring and no expense spared. And it does show, because I've got to say, this DCT is just fantastic. It's rifle bolt fast when you want it to be. You can poke the car into tight gaps without worrying you're going to get that horrible moment of lag and indecision. It's even got some functions, for instance, when you're at more than 90% throttle, it really makes sure that those shifts are instantaneous and keeps the torque as high as possible to sort of smooth it out. It's a relentless gearbox that is perfectly matched to the engine. And I have to say, it's opened up a whole new world of things to that car. I remember when ATCO, when our performance editor and WRC icon Chris Atkinson took the pre-update i30N on Queensland Raceway, he kept saying as much as he loved the manual and as much as he enjoyed heel and toeing, he was losing half a second a lap just because a well-suited DCT or PDK is always going to be snappier. When a guy like that says that, you got to listen. And I think it all makes sense after having driven the i30N update.
Was it just as engaging as the manual, though?
In a lot of ways, yes. I mean, I think the secret to this car is that it's almost endlessly configurable. So it's got three different active exhaust modes that, you know, take it from sort of a deep rumble all the way through to a manic scream, popping and burbling and crackling on the overrun on an upshift. You've got different diff settings. You've got paddles to control the gearbox. You've also got the race car logic of pulling it back to and pushing it forward, pulling it back to shift up and forward down. So there are a lot of things built into the car that really are all about engagement. And then the fact that this new turbocharger and intercooler setup with the snappier DCT is half a tenth faster to 100 than the manual at just 5.4 seconds, tamed by that electronically controlled mechanical front diff, it's not lacking engagement. It's not lacking fun factor. If anything, the ceiling is that much higher, and all of the different permutations that you can dial into this car just make it as engaging as ever, honestly. And you know, I'm not an anti-manual guy, quite the contrary. I love the old car, but this car is just objectively better.
What's the price difference between the two?
Yeah, so there's a bit of a hike. It's $3,000 for the auto over the manual. And one of the bugbears, I guess, of this new car, yes, it has a new massive touchscreen inside. It's got more active safety tech. It's got more power and torque. It's got some different, you know, suspension kinematics behind it. So it has had a lot of updates, but it is a more expensive vehicle. It used to start at $39,990. Now it starts at $44,500. And then it's $47,500 for the DCT. And then if you want to have the one that I had, which is the premium one with the sunroof and all the added features, you're looking at $52,000, which is $57,000 drive away. Mm-hmm. And then you're starting to get into Golf GTI, Golf R territory. And I actually think it's every bit as good as those cars, but it doesn't have the crazy price advantage that perhaps it did when it first launched.
Moco, with the DSG, Hyundai has put a lot of time and effort into this. It's been teasing it for quite a long time now. How does it behave around town, which is obviously arguably more difficult to do than just slamming home shifts? And also, how do the paddles feel? Because they're a really important part of a car like that that is often overlooked.
Yeah, so it passed some of my DSG or DCT, I should say, DSG being proprietary, but DCT tests. For example, I live on quite a busy road. If I want to turn onto a side street, I have to cross two lanes of opposite traffic. And if the gap is obviously not taking silly gaps, but if the gap requires you to kind of press on with it, sometimes a car with a DCT will have that moment of hesitation, none whatsoever in this. It's got the anti-creep function built into it, so you can stop it from rolling of its own volition as you would in a traditional automatic, which smooths things out. I tend to find with more torquey engines like this, DSGs or DCTs work better. You know, obviously Porsche's PDK being the absolute pinnacle. But no, around town, you know, in normal mode with the active dampers set to their softest setting, with the throttle numbed back to its numbest setting, and with the DSG program just to be as relaxed as possible, it really is just a pretty chilled out daily driver. It's got that real Jekyll and Hyde thing going pretty well.
Could this, if this becomes like a big hit, which we're assuming it could be, could this mean the end of the manual in the i30N maybe in the future?
Oh, I mean, I think as long as there's a petrol-powered, you know, or combustion-powered i30N, there'll be a manual. Don't forget that, you know, this is a company led by people who were instrumental at BMW, which continues to make manuals to this day. And this is a company that throws huge amounts of money at World Rally events and, you know, touring car events and TCR events. So I don't think the enthusiast side of things will be forgotten. Of course, the elephant in the room is electrification. We know that the Ioniq 5 is going to get an N version soon. You don't have manual electric cars. So clearly at some point, Hyundai's N hot hatches won't be manual anymore. But I would imagine that's a fair way away, thankfully, at least for the time being. There's actually one feature that I just have to mention here, which I love, and I think it sums up the i30N really well. It repackages functions that I found on other vehicles in a more fun way. And that's not just the turbo boost gauge and the power and torque gauges on the dash, and it's not just the crazy shift lights that you get just like in a race car, but it's probably embodied by the N-Grin shift mode, which is a little button on the steering wheel called NGS. You press it, you get a super dramatic countdown timer in the TFT instruments right in front of your eyes. It counts you down from 20, and it gives you 100% power and torque. It makes the transmission as aggressive as it can possibly be without exploding and, you know, blowing out the bonnet. And it just grabs you by the throat and just gives you everything for 20 seconds, full on.
Wow.
And yeah, Sports Plus modes in cars do that. This is not a new thing. You put your foot down, you get the most out of the car. No shite. But to have this whole dramatic experience based around it, it's just that extra level of engagement that Hyundai is just having fun with this car. It's just all about having a good time. And I think that sums it up really well, because I was grinning for all 20 seconds of it being on.
That's really cool that it just lasts for 20 seconds, because it makes you appreciate it even more. I really like that feature.
And let's be honest, if you've been full flat stick for 20 seconds, you're a long way north of any speed limit in Australia. So maybe save that one for the track.
You can search for Hyundai i30N at carexpert.com.au. Have you got a rating for it yet, Moko?
Yeah, I gave this one an 8.4 out of 10. You know, you can't ignore the fact that there's been some price creep. You can't ignore the fact that the headroom with the sunroof is pretty woeful, and the dash still feels a little bit kind of slapped together and ad hoc in parts. It does still feel a bit like a base i30 in terms of its trims and materials. But honestly, you take the vast majority of the feedback that's been directed to that car, and it's been addressed with this update, which is exactly the point of an update. So very hard to draw too many arguments with this car.
Did you know Tony Crawford owns a Porsche 911? So why did he buy one? We thought we might get him on to answer this question, because he's also written a story up at Car Expert. Hello, Crawf.
How are you, Mandy? That's 3,200 words on that story. No doubt the Scissorhands fraternity will snip away.
Hopefully
not too much.
Hello, Scott Scissorhands here, and I cannot wait to get my claws into it.
Look, my Mustang passion, which I've already written about on the site, which anyone would know that reads the site on a daily basis, started when I was much younger than the Porsche thing. I think my Porsche passion started probably around 11 or 12 when I saw the movie Le Mans, starring Steve McQueen as well, as it happens. And at the start of the movie is a wonderful sequence of Steve McQueen. There's no talking. It's just a faint sound of a car in the distance coming towards the village of Le Mans, and Steve McQueen is driving a 911 S, and probably a 67, 68, because the movie came out in 1971, a year after the 1970 Le Mans, which is where they got most of the footage from. Then many years passed before I would come across a 911 event, I'll call it, because I actually got to drive one when I was 18 going to school in America. And I think I may have told this story very quickly before, but recap, the car I was driving broke down. The family that I was living with at the time, he had as a toy a 911T with a 3-litre Carrera engine in it, not the 2.2 that the 911T came with. And let me tell you, I looked the weight of this car up, and it was 1,020 kilos, a 911T, and it had a 3-litre engine in it. So you can imagine when I got in this car, heading from a place called Hidden Hills or Calabasas down into Santa Monica, where the school I was attending was based. And this car felt like a rocket ship. And I was just simply challenging people on the 405, which was not as busy as it is today, and trying to race as many people as I could in this unbelievable car. I loved it was silver. I loved the look of it. I got in it. It wraps around you. And anyway, long story short, it would be another 20-odd years before I actually got a chance to buy my own, which was a 911 SC, a 1981 model, and 5-speed manual, as they were back then. And it was a color called Pacific Blue Metallic. I looked that up because I have this book that has all the colorways of each iteration of the 911. And, Pacific Blue Metallic. Yes, Scott.
So, Crawf, I'm curious, what did you pay for that 911 at the time, and what did you sell it for? Because those SCs are worth some serious money now.
Serious bucks. I bought it for $35,000, which was kind of a deal. I was selling programs to Channel 9 and Channel 7, fully finished programs, and we were just basically salespeople getting a commission. And for that, my partner's wife had that car, and she'd gone back to Canada, and he said, "Do you want to buy it? I'm selling it." And I said, "Oh yeah, let's just the next deal. You keep my share." So it was $35,000, and I sold it stupidly, like maniacally. I sold that car 3 years later, bought it in 95, sold it in 98, I believe, for $49,500. I seriously believe that car today, had I not put many Ks on it, would be worth over $200,000 because it was mint condition. It had a very unusual interior called Berber and beige cloth, and it was like a tweed jacket. And I've never seen one outside of that. And I believe my colorway was one of two cars only imported into Australia by John Newell and sold new, I think, for $48,000 in 81. That would have been a hell of a lot of money. Anyway, I had to sell that car to get married and pay some bills.
Oh, no.
And it would be, you know, again, 20 years later, when we sold Car Advice and I had some money, and I'd actually put an order down for a GT3 RS. Talked about that with my wife, and she thought it was literally in that I should be locked up in an asylum for spending that amount of money on a single car. I didn't agree, but she did win the argument, and $200,000 was no small amount of money either, and that bought me a 2013 991 Carrera S with all the performance options. And I tell you, I drive that car, and here's the interesting thing that I put in my review, and you can read it next week, I hope, maybe, is that that car felt like I was in – it didn't feel really a lot different from the 911T or the 911 SC. They all felt the same in that they're lightweight and you can feel this incredible sensitivity through the steering wheel and the pedals, and you have – you know, it's a naturally aspirated engine. It's not air-cooled like the 911 SC was. But it is naturally aspirated, and you get this instantaneous throttle response, which I just I'm addicted to it. And it's not there in the 992 or the 991.2 when they went to a twin turbo 3 liter. You still get this infinitesimal but very small amount of lag, but it's there, and you know it's there, and you can feel it, and you can't feel it on mine. It just goes, and of course, it's not as fast, but I think speed and 0 to 100 is irrelevant when it comes to feel that you get. And Mandy, you probably know that the Speedster's probably even got more feel than mine. Scott, what were you?
I was just going to say, Crawf, with the 911, obviously it's one of those cars that people tend to want for their whole life and then buy exactly the right spec. You can have so many different options. Can you talk us through what you've actually got on yours, whether you went the manual or the PDK, and what options it has?
Yeah, it was ordered by the head of Porsche Brisbane, and he put everything onto it. So that meant that it has, first of all, PDK, which was an option. Then it has adaptive PASM, which I'm not sure. I can't work out whether Porsche Active Suspension Management was standard on a Carrera S or optional.
I want to take a punt and say it was optional, but I can't confirm that.
No, it might have been optional on a Carrera and not on mine, but I did get the specs the other day, and it says it was standard and with a lowered ride height of 10 mil. But you could get PASM with a sport chassis, which was reduced 20 mil ride height. I believe that's what I have because my car is very low. It also sits on 20-inch alloys. Now that was standard, but the guy swapped it out for turbo wheels, so they're turbo platinum, and it looks sensational against the Carrera white that my car is. It also has a sports exhaust. It also has sport chrono, and it also has a sport design steering wheel, which was optional, believe it or not. So you had to settle for, even with the Carrera S, you had to settle for these stupid buttons on the steering wheel. And you had to, if you wanted to exit that, I think it was $4,000 for the sport design steering wheel with paddle shifters. And they're beautiful. They're aluminium. They're designed. It looks like they're forged paddle shifters. And it's just fantastic. I mean, the one thing I do when I start the car up is I immediately push the sport button, because that opens the butterfly valves up in the sports exhaust and creates this very loud howl. It's a howl when the flat sixes over 4,000, they start to howl, and it's a most wonderfully addictive sound. I mean, my car redlines at 7,400 RPM. I don't think I've hit 7,400 and until I was on the farm on a private racetrack. It's I can thoroughly recommend them to anyone. They're cheap to service. I pay $695 every year to service it, for an intermediate service, they call it, and that has a major service. I think every 3 years, and that costs about $2,200. But, you know, with that, you get a brand new Macan loan car. You don't have to pay for that. They load you up with a gift, whether that might be a Porsche-branded tire pressure gauge, and they give you whatever you want in terms of bottles of Tampelli. I mean, it's not much, but all these little things add up. But $695 for a service is cheaper than most BMWs cost to service. So, you know, that's the thing with Porsches. They've always had this reliability, this robustness, and they are cheap to service, and you can thrash them day in, day out with any ill side effect of that flat six engine. And, you know, now we're approaching at 70 years or however many years the 911 has been around. I think it was 68, 67 maybe. Maybe it was even 66 when they came out with
the 901. It might have been it was released when the 356 was just coming to an end. So it would have been 65 I think that's, in other parts of the world.
I reckon that's 66.
It would be 66. They were starting to make them in 65.
Wow. Okay. So, and then they had the 912 come in, which was a four-cylinder version for people that maybe couldn't afford the flat six. And, you know, it stood the test of time, right? I said at the end, you know, what I liked about the car, it's that silhouette. It's that unmistakable 911 silhouette that almost anyone can draw one line and you know what they're going to draw. And that's what I love about it. I love the racing heritage that it comes with. I love the fact that it's been driven by lots of famous people. It's still regarded as the best all-round sports car in the world. It has four seats. It has luggage space. What's not to like about a Porsche 911?
Agreed. I was actually going to ask you something you just touched on there, Croft. I had a 74 911, and every time I got in that car, I instantly thought of its heritage and its history.
Yes. 100%.
I know you sort of maybe just said it just then though, but do you think it's the greatest sports car ever made?
I do. It's design, it's evolution perfection in the automotive world. Every single iteration that comes out is better than the previous one. And you may not like the fact that it's grown substantially from the 901 and right through to the original 911, that it has grown. I've got a book that they gave me a few years ago. It has a cellophane or a transfer paper that and over each one you lay the next sheet or the next iteration. It shows you where the car has grown, and you know they've generally grown front and back. They've just become bigger, and of course we all know why. It's all about safety now. And you know, this iteration, the 992, is the biggest of all time. But I believe, you know, I haven't driven any of the GT cars. I've only driven the original, and it is sensational. But if I was to say a negative and why I'd like mine better, would be that instantaneous non-turbo throttle response you get. You just don't get it, and you know, I really love that. And I don't know whether I'd swap my 991. For a 992, if someone offered me that, I think I'd probably tend to keep the 991 because, you know, you're not going to get any more naturally aspirated flat six engines anymore. They're gone. They're finished. Mm-hmm. And I believe my car will go up and up from here on. I've looked at them recently and I believe I could sell it right now for what I paid for it 5 years ago. And I think I'd be mad to, because I think in 4 years' time they'll go up again another 20%, maybe 10%, you know. So, fantastic car. Look, I said in my piece I've got a lusting for two cars right now, the Lamborghini Huracan Evo and a Ferrari 812 Superfast. But I said I probably wouldn't swap. If I had to give up the 911 Carrera S 2013, I wouldn't. It's a hero car. It's an icon. It's an icon, right, in the automotive world, where the other two aren't.
Well, that
seems like you were more of a Corolla hybrid guy, Croft.
No, mate, I could probably find something good to say about a Corolla hybrid. I do remember the Corolla when, you know, the latest iteration or generation, they had a very good CVT. They had a very good step through that and that's about what I can say about the Corolla hybrid.
All right, I think we might end it there now. Yeah, we're looking forward to that write-up coming up at the website very soon. Thank you, Tony Crawford.
I appreciate it, guys.
Coupe SUVs, love them or hate them, they're here to stay, and it seems not just the Germans who are making them. Renault has joined the club with the Arkana. I've got to say, Scully, this is actually a bit of a looker. I was a bit surprised.
I am not a coupe SUV fan usually, but this one looks really, really good. I don't know what it is about the Arkana, but it's definitely, it's got something about it that makes it more of a coupe than most of these other sort of hunchback SUV combos. So Renault's done a really good job on that front. It's quite an interesting car because it replaces the Kadjar, which was sort of a Nissan Qashqai clone that was sold here for less than 2 years. And it's a similar size to a Mazda CX-5, but it's priced quite affordably and it's a little bit sexier. It slots into quite an interesting niche that I didn't really know existed. So Renault is clearly going for something that no one else is doing here.
What sort of pricing are we looking at for this?
So pricing kicks off at $33,990 before on-roads for the Arkana Zen. The car we had was the Intense, which in most Renault ranges is the top of the range. It's priced at $37,490 before on-roads, but the Arkana will debut the RS line trim in Australia at $49,90 before on-road costs, and that's essentially Renault's equivalent of Hyundai N-Line or BMW M Sport. It's going to look a bit sportier and have a little bit more equipment again. They're going to arrive late this year, early next, from memory, I think early next year. But the Arkana Intens is the mid-range model, and it's the one that if you want all of the luxuries and the bits and pieces, but you don't want a sporty looking or, you know, an over the top looking car, that's the one you'd go for.
Do you think Renault has priced it well?
I do. I was actually really surprised by the pricing on it because the Captur, which is technically the same car underneath, but is also significantly smaller than the Arkana, the equivalent Captur is only sort of $1,000 less expensive. When you look at the equivalent rivals over at Mazda and Volkswagen, you're not getting all that much CX-30 for the money, and a T-Roc 110 TSI with a few options packs doesn't feel or look quite as stylish as the Arkana, but is a very similar price. So Renault's definitely found an interesting little niche there. I think the challenge it has with pricing is, although it stacks up really well against some of the more style-focused smaller cars, it also is priced in the same sort of area as entry-level Mazda CX-5, Ford Escape, Toyota RAV4, that sort of thing when you get to the Intense. And although it has a lot more luxury kit inside, although it looks a bit sportier, it is a less practical car than those, and that might turn some people off. So it sort of crosses over between segments a little bit.
One of the big advantages of this car is it actually comes out of South Korea. Correct me if I'm wrong, Scully. But Yeah, so made by Samsung or badged Samsung in that market. Obviously, we have a free trade agreement with South Korea, and we don't with Europe, where the European models are made and where the Kadjar was made. And obviously, it's a slightly shorter ship time. So I suspect those two things have conspired to make the price a bit more competitive, which really kind of taps into what you're saying.
That was also one of the reasons Renault said it wanted the Arkana when it actually announced it was coming. The Kadjar came from Spain and it was quite expensive to source. It was missing some equipment from the factory as well that maybe in Europe it made sense to option, but in Australia where Renault's positioned differently, it didn't make sense. So the fact it is Korean built was one of the big drivers for Renault getting this car here. And this obviously all happened before Renault switched from a factory distribution to a Tico distribution, but Atico has clearly seen the opportunity with the Korean-built car.
How does the cabin stack up, especially in the back with that sloping rear design?
So it's really stylish to look at. I love what Renault is doing with its design at the moment. We talked about Megane E-Tech, which is the next sort of generation of that again. But the Intense gets a really cool vertically oriented touchscreen in the middle. The Intense also gets leather seats that are heated and cooled, a beautiful leather steering wheel. Everything gets a digital driver's display, which is not the full digital one that you can option. It's $800 extra, but all the main stuff is digital in a screen in the middle, and then there's two analog sort of lit up gauges beside it. It looks awesome. It looks really unique and really premium. It feels fairly premium. Most of the stuff you touch is good, although there are still some, you know, harder plastics because this is a $37,000 car, not a $80,000 car. I think the thing that lets it down a little bit is the technology, because as good as that touchscreen looks, the graphics aren't all that flash and it's a little bit slow, especially when it looks that good, you would expect it to perform as well, and it doesn't quite. And yeah, even in the front seat with the sunroof that our test car had, headroom's not great. I really felt like I was sitting up in the clouds. And if you're sitting in the back or you want to carry tall teenagers around, or maybe you've got a friend with a giant afro, or maybe they like wearing top hats, whatever it is, they're not going to be as comfortable in the Arcana as they are in something like a CX-5 or a RAV4, which is more practical again. It also shows up in the boot. The Arcana does have a big boot. It's long and flat, but because that sloping roofline is so aggressive, it's not all that much bigger in the back than the Captor, although I would argue it's a more practical space. So there is a trade-off for that style, and it does come in the back of the car.
Okay. So how does it drive?
It drives exactly like you would expect it to. Which is probably not much help to anyone who's not driven a Renault recently. But it's got a variation of the same 1.3-litre engine that's in the Captor. And it's also got the same dual-clutch transmission. It's built on the same platform. It weighs roundly the same amount, although it is a little bit bigger. And that means that it's a pretty nice thing to drive. The engine with 115 kilowatts of power and 262 newton meters of torque, it's not a hot hatch engine, but it actually has quite a lot of punch. And the way it gives you a little shove in the back when you put your foot down is pretty cool. The dual clutch is pretty good. It's a little bit jerky off the mark, but once you're up and rolling, it does that dual clutch thing where it just bangs through the gears really decisively. It's interesting, jumping out of a couple of torque converter cars into the Arcana, it really is noticeable how much faster the dual clutch shifts, but there is a little bit of a learning curve there. I also really like the way it handles. I know this is all positive stuff and you want to hear me be mean, but it feels really light on its feet. You turn the wheel and it kind of just goes where you want it to. It's riding on quality rubber, so it sort of feels really nice and grippy when you throw it into a corner, and it rides really nicely. It floats along reasonably well. You definitely do feel some sharper bumps inside. This is still a reasonably small car on reasonably big wheels, and it's not, you know, super high-end expensive stuff on air suspension. So when you hit sharp bumps, they do whack into the cabin, but for the most part, it just does a really good job of feeling like a zippy little city SUV. Where it falls down a little bit is that it's a little bit noisy inside on the highway. You notice those tires really roar through the cabin, and that's pretty common with Euro cars. They've got beautiful, smooth bitumen overseas, and even though this is built in Korea, cars that aren't designed in Australia or tuned in Australia tend to struggle on Australia's roads, which are pretty average. The other thing that you'll notice about the Arcana is that DCT can be a little bit slow going from drive to reverse or something like that. So, again, that's not uncommon with dual-clutch cars, but it just means that if you are trying to quickly reverse park or you're trying to, you know, get into your garage spot, you've got to clunk it into reverse, wait for it to give you a beep, and then you go. And that's something that you'll learn to do when you own the car, but there is a little bit of a learning curve there. Although, and last thing I'll say about this is that it's really good that Renault's given this car a proper transmission shifter. It slides properly from P, R, and D, and it clicks into spot. The Captor's got this weird little joystick, which is becoming really common in a lot of cars, and you never know whether it's in drive, reverse, or neutral. So although the transmission can be just a little bit dual-clutch kind of awkward, at least you know what gear you're in the Arcana.
So, Scully, I'm a bit confused. What sort of person would buy this?
That's a really good question. It's one that I was kind of wondering when I was driving the car myself, but I think this is very much a mainstream or an affordable alternative to something like an Audi Q3 Sportback, which is their coupe-styled one, or a BMW X2. It's the sort of person who doesn't want to chuck people in the back or lug a whole lot of stuff around. They kind of want to look different and stand out a bit. And I think it fills that niche really neatly. It also feels like a niche that Renault should be filling, because realistically, Renault as a brand is never going to hit the sales heights of a Mazda or of a Hyundai or of a Kia, although, you know, maybe that's what they want to do and that's a different conversation. But it does have the sort of badge credibility in that it's French. It's got a really interesting history that we've already touched on. So I think if Renault can get people to sit in these cars, to look at them, to drive them, which is always a challenge for smaller brands, there's definitely enough people out there who want to look different and who want to stand out a bit that will be drawn by it, because it really is a handsome car in person, and it drives quite nicely to back it up.
Yeah, absolutely. You can check out that review now at carexpert.com.au, where you've given it a 7.7 rating. Episode 61 of the Car Expert podcast is done and dusted. What cars can we look forward to next week, Scully?
So in Melbourne at the moment, we have got a Havel Jolyon, a Toyota Kluger, which I'm driving. It's a big, comfy family bus. The Hyundai Staria, the Skoda Scala 110 TSI Launch Edition, and a Golf 110 TSI. Moco, I can hear some interesting things coming from you on that one. Mm. And then next week, we're picking up an Audi Q2, a Golf Wagon, which I'm very excited to have a look at, a Suzuki Vitara Turbo two-wheel drive, a Skoda Octavia 110 TSI, and a Toyota Prius. They still make the Prius. Up north, Alborz is driving the Mercedes G400D, the diesel G-Wagon, which, after talking about the electric one, doesn't sound quite as exciting, but I'll be very interested to see what he thinks of it. And in Sydney, we've got a Lexus RX 450 hybrid seven-seater.
Very, very nice. Awesome. Well, if you haven't given us a rating yet and you've just joined the Car Expert podcast, please do. Well, whatever podcast platform you use, we'd really appreciate it. Mike Costello, Scott Colley, thank you very much.
Thanks, Mandy.
Thanks, guys.